The story of the tax-exempt foundations begins on March 26, 1852, when George Peabody, the man widely regarded as the father of modern philanthropy, writes an open letter to the London Times, in which he announces his intention to ameliorate the condition of the poor and needy of this great metropolis, and to promote their comfort and happiness. Peabody went on to say that we have today to announce an act of beneficence unexampled in its largeness and in the time and manner of the gift. Originally named the Peabody Donation Fund, its focus was on urban regeneration with a vast array of community programs throughout the poorer neighborhoods of London. Shortly thereafter, Peabody would turn his focus to the development of an education system within North America, and with an original donation of $3.5 million to encourage the intellectual, moral, and industrial education of the destitute children of the southern states, Peabody, working in lockstep with educational reformers like Horace Mann, Edward Everett, and William Torrey Harris, set in motion the wheels of educational reform in the United States. Peabody would go on to establish institutes of learning for both student and teacher, as well as several libraries and museums, including the Peabody Institute in 1852. When Peabody retired, he was worth $230 million in today's dollars, and it is directly from Peabody's financial empire that the huge multinational banking conglomerates of today, J.P. Morgan, the Deutsche Bank, and Morgan Stanley, can all trace their origins. Peabody is without a doubt a central figure in the creation of modern finance, but he was also instrumental in the creation of a philanthropic blueprint from which other immensely wealthy giants of industry like John D. Rockefeller, Andrew Carnegie, Johns Hopkins, David Guggenheim, and Henry Ford would soon follow. These names are today widely regarded as the pioneers of philanthropy, yet extensive empirical proof reveals a far darker purpose lurking just under the surface of their giving nature. Under further scrutiny, we see that the foundations were not only being used as obvious tax havens, but they were also being used primarily to wield unprecedented influence over the various control mechanisms of not only Western society, but the entire world. And the world we live in today can all be traced back directly to these early captains of industry and their giant tax-free foundations. On July 8, 1839, John Davison Rockefeller is born in Richford, New York, to a devoutly religious woman named Eliza, and a notorious vagabond snake oil salesman known as Devil Bill. As if by divine providence, young John enters the world just as the Industrial Revolution was sweeping west across the plains of America. As a young boy, John would make money by raising and selling turkeys from the family's small farmhouse, and while his mother taught him to save money, his father taught him to always get the better of any deal, and John would certainly take their advice to heart. By the age of 7, he'd accumulated considerable savings, enough to loan $50 to a local farmer at 7% interest. Upon the return of the loan, 1 year later, John was amazed to learn that the interest had gained him the equivalent of 10 days' labor. John had discovered the power of compound interest, and it was this profound discovery that would change the fortunes of the Rockefeller family forever. John would later recollect that from that time onward, I determined to make money work for me. By the midway point of the 19th century, the United States had discovered her vast potential At the same time, John D. Rockefeller was entering the business world, and the two were an immediate match made in heaven. With discoveries of large deposits of oil, iron, copper, and tin, the U.S. was able to break free from her economic dependency upon Britain. Americans were being introduced to an entirely new vocabulary, as words like corporation, stockholder, corporate merger, and monopoly capitalism were upon the lips of aspiring businessmen from New York all the way to the burgeoning West Coast. With industrialists like Rockefeller driving like steam pistons within the massive machine of industrial progress, America seemingly transformed overnight. And by the end of the 19th century, the frontier towns of the Gilded Age, made famous by Mark Twain, had faded into the dusty back pages of history, paved over by a more metropolitan, urban lifestyle of concrete roadways, steel skyscrapers, and the combustion engine. With the help of industry, the United States bloomed beyond her borders, and she burst onto the international scene and would transform into an empire within a single generation. As the modern period came to an end, the postmodern period changed America's image forever, and the iconic John D. Rockefeller would prove to be both its progenitor and its greatest benefactor. On August 27th, 1859, oil was discovered in Titusville, Pennsylvania, and thousands of men in search of fortune flooded the area. Oil derricks began to dominate the American landscape, and while some of the early oil prospectors were successful, many gambled and lost everything. Rockefeller learned quickly to minimize risk by investing in the one thing that was guaranteed, the oil refinery. For no matter where the oil came from, it all had to be refined. And in 1862, at the age of 22, along with his partner and fellow classmate M.B. Clark and chemist Samuel Andrews, young John first enters the oil industry. 5 years later, with the help of his brother William and business partners, he formed Rockefeller, Andrews, and Flagler. Eventually, Rockefeller would buy out his partners to become sole proprietor, and over the next 20 years, through cutthroat business tactics, would go on to dominate the oil industry.
John Davidson Rockefeller got into the oil business almost as an afterthought. At the age of 19, he and a partner had formed a produce shipping firm in Cleveland, Ohio, specializing in pork, salt, and wheat. During the early years of the Civil War, Rockefeller's produce firm prospered as wartime demands for these staples increased. Already a wealthy man by his late 20s, Rockefeller saw the future one cold fall day in 1863 when a new railroad reached Cleveland. Now, Cleveland was linked to the oil-rich regions of Pennsylvania. Dozens of petroleum refineries quickly sprang up along the city's rail lines. Rockefeller knew an opportunity when he saw one. In 1864, he bought his first oil refinery. It did not take him long to realize that the profit potential dwarfed that of the produce business. He became convinced that his future lay in oil, not commodity exchange.
Rockefeller's entry into oil refining follows, I think, a careful analysis of the commodity by Rockefeller himself. He saw the potential in this. Its lighting capability was much higher than candles or camphene or sperm oil. And he probably saw the potential, but he also heard what I would call the ruckus coming from the Pennsylvania border, because by the mid-1860s, Cleveland's newspapers were awash with stories of the fortunes being made, lost in the oil fields near Titusville and in western Pennsylvania.
On January 10, 1870, Rockefeller formed Standard Oil, and after buying out 22 of his 26 competitors in an event now known as the Cleveland Conquest, Rockefeller became the proud owner of the majority of oil refineries along the Cuyahoga River. By 1882, through the horizontal integration of affiliated railway, pipeline, and shipping infrastructure, Rockefeller would end up controlling over 90% of the refineries in the United States. Eventually, Standard Oil Trust grew to include 20,000 domestic wells, 4,000 miles of pipeline, 5,000 tank cars, and over 100,000 employees. Standard Oil was the largest oil company not only in America, but in the world, and John D. Rockefeller was the richest man in U.S. history. Like his father before him, Rockefeller's aggressive business strategies earned him constant public ridicule. Countless newspaper articles relentlessly criticized Rockefeller, often portraying him as a monster, labeling him as public enemy number one. According to the New York World, Standard Oil was the most cruel, impudent, pitiless, and grasping monopoly that had ever fastened upon a country, and the vast majority of the American public agreed. Rockefeller's public persona and family reputation would be dragged through the mud several times during this period, but never more aggressively than by a young investigative journalist named Ida Tarbell. In a 1902 edition of McClure's magazine, Tarbell exposed Standard Oil for its predatory behavior and outed John's father as a bigamist, a thief, and a convicted rapist. But it didn't end there. In 1898, Rockefeller's behavior had also caught the attention of the highest levels of U.S. government. Then-President William McKinley's Industrial Commission began an investigation into the pricing policies, industrial concentration, and treatment of immigration and labor markets by large corporations like Rockefeller's Standard Oil and the Carnegie Steel Company. Following a tumultuous decade to begin the 20th century, one in which Rockefeller would repeatedly be investigated, the Supreme Court eventually ordered the Standard Oil Trust to be dissolved under Sherman antitrust laws. Standard Oil was ordered by McKinley's successor, Theodore Roosevelt, to split into 34 smaller subsidiaries. And Rockefeller, now 72, and having long since retired, not only escaped the public scrutiny unscathed, but the value of his shares in Standard Oil had skyrocketed, all while his monopolization of the oil industry continues to this very day.
On May 15, 1911, the Supreme Court of the United States declared that Standard Oil was a monopoly in restraint of trade and should be dissolved. As Rockefeller foresaw, the individual Standard Oil companies were worth more than the single corporation. In the next few years, their shares doubled and tripled in value. By the time the reign of cash was over, Rockefeller had the greatest personal fortune in history, nearly 2% of the American economy.
And it was really losing the antitrust case that converted John D. Rockefeller into history's first billionaire. So that Standard Oil was punished in the federal antitrust case, but John D. Rockefeller Sr. most assuredly was not.
Standard Oil of Kentucky and California eventually become Chevron. Eastern State Standard Oil of New York and New Jersey dissolve into Exxon, and Standard Oil of Indiana and Ohio become British Petroleum. While Rockefeller deftly maneuvered his way through the Supreme Court investigation to not only reform the oil industry to his liking, he would now focus on the molding of American society itself by using his exorbitant personal wealth to overhaul the medical industry, the agricultural industry, and the academic and educational systems of the entire United States. But despite his reputation as one of the most despised figures in America, Rockefeller's wealth continued to grow to such unprecedented levels that the weight of it threatened to destroy his entire empire. He was desperate to free himself from the crushing estate tax burden and would eventually hire a financial advisor who suggested tax-free philanthropy. Frederick T. Gates, also a Baptist minister, was put in charge of distributing Rockefeller's massive wealth. He donated to several smaller colleges and gifted an initial $80 million grant to a small Baptist college that would eventually become the University of Chicago. He also created the Institute for Medical Research, into which hundreds of millions of dollars would be spent in the development of our modern medical industry. But more specific to this story, it was in 1902, with the creation of the tax-exempt General Education Board, that Rockefeller would form the instrument through which hundreds of millions of more dollars would be funneled into the restructuring of the entire public education system. And such a bold maneuver certainly did not go unnoticed. Newspapers, politicians, and the public alike vociferously complained of the deal. They raised questions regarding the moral and ethical consequences of allowing an oil magnate billionaire to single-handedly recreate the entire United States public education system simply upon the prestige of wealth. This voice, most well represented by the manufacturer's record, taken from congressional testimony in 1917. Control, through possession of the millions massed in the educational trust, of two or three or four times as many millions of dollars in education, makes possible control of the machinery and the methods of education. It makes it possible for the central controlling body to determine the whole character of American education, the textbooks to be used, the aims to be emphasized. Operating through state, denominational, and individual systems of schools and colleges, it gives the financial controller power to impose upon its beneficiaries its own views, good or bad, and thereby to dominate public opinion in social, economic, and political matters. History would show that these complaints did little to deter Rockefeller. In fact, he would appoint Gates as the first president of the GEB. Gates presided over a 10-member board of trustees that included men considered today as luminaries of our present-day education system in Wallace Buttrick as its first secretary and executive officer. The GEB would receive an initial $1 million grant from John D. Rockefeller Sr. to be expended at its discretion during a period of 10 years and will make payments under such pledges from time to time as requested by the board or its executive committee through its duly authorized officers. The following is the General Education Board's first mission statement, written by Gates in 1906, called Occasional Letter Number 1. In our dream, we have limitless resources, and the people yield themselves with perfect docility to our molding hand. The present educational conventions fade from our minds, and unhampered by tradition, we work our own goodwill upon a grateful and responsive rural folk. We shall not try to make these people, or any of their children, into philosophers, or men of learning, or of science. We are not to raise up from among them authors, orators, poets, or men of letters. We shall not search for embryo great artists, painters, musicians. nor will we cherish even the humbler ambition to raise up from among them lawyers, doctors, preachers, politicians, statesmen, of whom we now have ample supply. Shortly thereafter, Rockefeller sent a second letter dated March 1, 1902 to the board's chairman, William H. Baldwin, Jr., indicating the intentions of their now famous mandate, which was to promote education in the United States of America without distinction of sex, race, or creed. This sentence serves as a perfect example of Aesopian language, in that while it sounds humanitarian to suggest the inclusion of everyone within a system of education, it quickly can be interpreted as malevolent or even insidious the moment it is made mandatory and refusal becomes punishable by law, unconstitutional and even inhumane when the goal becomes the removal of a student's free will or individuality. Rockefeller would donate $43 million in the first 5 years of the GEB's existence, and it is through these grants that our modern-day school system of indoctrination was born. In the following decades, Rockefeller money would saturate research departments at nearly every major American university, including the psychology department at Harvard, the very laboratory in which famous behaviorist B.F. Skinner was carrying out his surreptitious operant conditioning techniques.
What Skinner was able to do in very carefully controlled studies with animal models was they demonstrate that whole chains of behaviors could be built step by step so that literally you could teach a pigeon to do complicated behaviors that no one would have predicted possible.
And Skinner believes that if it works for pigeons, why not people? In Skinner's mind, behavior is behavior, up and down the evolutionary scale, and it is all learned. One of the great successes is in education. People are taught to do more complicated tasks than anyone had thought possible by breaking down behavior into small steps and giving positive reinforcement along the way.
Skinner's positive reinforcement techniques removed the reward a student naturally felt from the successful accomplishment of a chosen task with a secondary material reward, and why today we see with every passing generation more importance put upon the reward to be received rather than the natural reward one feels from acting and behaving in a proper ethical and moral manner. This system of positive reinforcement, seemingly normal today, simply because it is the only system we have ever known, and this overt experimentation of our entire Western education system can be seen plainly stated within the original mandate of the General Education Board. To endow elementary schools or primary schools, industrial schools, technical schools, normal schools, training schools for teachers, or schools of any grade, or higher institutions of learning, to cooperate with associations engaged in educational work, to donate property, to collect educational statistics and information, to publish and distribute documents and reports, and in general to do and perform all things necessary or convenient for the promotion of the object of the corporation. Under the order thus conferred, the entire field of education in the United States, taking the word education in its broadest significance, is open to the General Education Board. It can undertake educational experimentation along new and hitherto untried lines, whether at the primary, academic, technical, industrial, or professional level. In exchange for tens of millions of dollars in grant money, Rockefeller had free rein to engage in whatever educational experimentation he felt necessary to be understood in its widest interpretation. This allowed Rockefeller to set the curriculum and guidelines for not only the students, but the teachers, and was seen by outsiders as a very nefarious relationship, later evidenced by statements made during the Reese Committee's investigation into the tax-free foundations by Dr. Ernest Victor Hollis, Chief of College Administration in the United States Office of Education, when he explained, It was a case of conform or no Grant. When to conform meant bathing in a stream of millions. College and university administrators and their faculties were inclined to conform. The scope of the board's mandate was three-part. Primarily, it was for the promotion of practical farming in the southern states. And this promotion of practical farming, seemingly out of place within the context of public education, allowed Rockefeller's far-reaching tentacles to also infiltrate and set guidelines within the agricultural industry. The second goal of the GEB mandate was the development of a system of public high schools in the southern states. And thirdly, the promotion of higher education throughout the entire United States. The restructuring of education in the South was a responsibility largely left to the GEB trustees, Peabody, Ogden, Curry, and Buttrick, working as agents for the Slater Fund, along with several other prominent privately owned interlocking intermediaries. These traveling agents would make all the necessary preparations for the construction of schools in areas deemed to be important population centers. Following the precedent set by George Peabody 50 years earlier, we see private organizations and government institutions openly working together for the purpose of radical educational reform. The foundations were able to use their largesse and prestige to intimidate and persuade detractors or nonconformists, while also appeasing the government through large financial donations to individual senators and representatives. This strategy was essential in the passing of legislation on the county, state, and federal levels by using subsidiary affiliations or clearinghouses like the Slater Fund, the Peabody Fund, and the Southern Education Board as the conduit. This ultimately culminated in the creation of a universal education model much the same as the father of German National Socialism, Johann Fichte, created in Prussia, that aimed at destroying the pupil's individuality in the soil without distinction of sex, color, or creed. Despite considerable public opposition, like that displayed in the following statement from the New Orleans Times Democrat, Rockefeller's vision would eventually become the accepted system of public schooling and remains largely unchanged to this day. The case here is plainly stated. The fund which the General Education Board administers is largely provided by men whose interest in shaping public opinion upon certain matters of vital concern to society and to the state is very great. Whether their philanthropy serves as a cloak to attain the ends desired, or whether the plan is unselfishly conceived and the sinister influence unconsciously exerted, the edict is likely to be the same in the end. So it is with over 100 years of forensic history that we can now look back to witness the results of Rockefeller's personal vision. And what we clearly see is the damage that results when one man, or a small group of men, working within the shadows, unelected by the populace, in aspects of society they are largely unqualified, are given free rein to fulfill their own whimsical fantasies. We have been availed the incredible ability to learn from our mistakes or be doomed to repeat them. And whether this sinister influence was consciously or unconsciously exerted matters not, as the end result is plain to see. Despite considerable public opposition, Rockefeller's corrupt industrial machine continued to steamroll everything in its path with very little concern for the future of America. Join me for the next installment of the history of propaganda, when we will follow the money trail even further down the rabbit hole and uncover the motivations that propelled the Rockefeller name onto the international stage, as the family used the same techniques of bribery that shaped domestic policy to create the global control mechanisms we know today as the United Nations, UNESCO, and NATO.